Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is based in Los Angeles, where the riots in 1992 informed his most recent novel, All Involved. He's a teacher as well as an award-winning author. He creates street art and video games, promotes cultural heritage, is the judge of what he calls the best taco competition in the world, and has a giant tattoo stretching from his neck to the middle of his thighs. I'm hoping that during the course of this interview, he'll strip off and show me. Ryan Gatiss, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Yes, thank you. That was quite an introduction.
The city of LA informs much of your work. Yeah. But you didn't actually grow up there. You grew up in Colorado.
Yes, that's right. I grew up in Colorado Springs, actually. I'm from an Air Force family. I was born on Scott Air Base in 1978. My dad actually resigned his commission as a captain within a year and moved the family to Colorado Springs and bought a house on a hill that looked down on the Air Force Academy and basically told my brother and I, that's where you're going, that's your future, that's what I expect of you.
And in fact, you had a really defining moment in your teens, which actually changed the course of your life and made you perhaps reconsider going into the Air Force.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think I was 17. I was, to that point, completely planning on going into the Air Force, mainly because my brother had said, nope, I'm not doing that. Not at all. It didn't matter that, of course, my father had been in the Air Force, my grandfather, before it was even an Air Force. So I think in my case, you know, I was doing everything that I possibly could. It's not easy getting into the military academies. I would say it's much more difficult than even Ivy League, because you need to do sports, you need to do every extracurricular activity, and you need to be doing student government in addition to having the highest possible grades and pass their physical fitness tests. It's really rigorous. And I was ready for that. I was kind of, I ticked all the boxes. Mm-hmm. And I was actually in said student government class when I was 17, when I was struck by one of the other students there who happened to be on acid at the time. And he asked me if I wanted to play fight. I said no. I turned and he struck me with an elbow that tore all the cartilage out of my nasal notch and put my nose on the side of my face.
Lord.
Yeah. The good news is I went into shock, so I didn't, you know, completely feel that. But I think that the really difficult thing was the healing process. I had two facial reconstructive surgeries. One was incredibly medieval. It's called a closed reduction and involved a surgeon sticking a metal rod up what was left of my nose and trying to bring it back. I'll spare you the details of how that went, but I can tell you that it was so bad, my father, who was holding my hand at the time, blacked out. The open reconstruction is basically just going under the knife, and I'll spare you the details of that one as well, but they had to peel the skin back and put the nose back where it needed to be. But it went even further than that, because there was so much nerve damage, I couldn't actually smell or taste after it happened. And my Swedish surgeon actually said, yeah, you'll probably never smell or taste again. So it was actually a really wonderful blessing when a year later, my sense of taste and smell started coming back. But I think during that whole year, really, I became a bit of a hermit. I really threw myself into reading and into watching films, because I found that up to that point, my life had been fairly charmed. I hadn't dealt with a tremendous amount of adversity. And when everything came at once at a very seminal time, I had no choice but to turn to art and hopefully find stories of people who had been through similarly difficult things, because that was the only way I could empathize. I lost so many friends over it because people just didn't have anything to talk to me about, they thought, afterward. And so I think in some small way, it made me a writer. I'm extremely grateful for it in retrospect, which is maybe a weird thing to say, but you know, it was an accident. I didn't have any control over it, but you know, all that I can do is learn from it and use it. I think I use it in some ways in my fiction.
Did you choose the nose you have now? It's very beautiful.
No. That's very kind of you to say. No, I had no say in the matter, but I will say this. It's my niece, my brother's daughter, has the nose I used to have through the miracle of genetics. And it's actually quite strange sometimes. I tease her about it and she doesn't like being teased about it.
How did you take that desire then to write forward?
I went to film school initially. During my bachelor's program, I was working on that and it was an absolute disaster because I found out very quickly that having been raised in a military family, being extremely accustomed to the idea of teamwork and discipline, that I was more than willing to help out everyone on my film course. And yet, when it came time for them to help me, it was a ghost town, you know, and that was very difficult. But I think it was going to Australia. I went to school there for a semester or so, and I did some film, but I also realized, you know, I can trust myself to write. And that's kind of the beauty of being a prose writer, or even a nonfiction writer. You know that you really only have to depend on yourself. And so I wrote a few short stories there. And when I went back, I changed my major and had to fight to catch up and actually make sure I graduated in time with my scholarship, because it really set me back changing my major. But it was worth it.
You studied under the former poet laureate Andrew Motion at the University of East Anglia, too.
I did, yes.
Is there a kind of big name anxiety associated with that kind of study when you have somebody who's so prominent lecturing you?
I think I had, and I'm sure you may have heard this a few times, but at least in my case, it was completely true. I had the virtue of ignorance on my side. Having been an American who was not very well read, I wasn't as scared of him, perhaps, as I should have been at the time. And I was certainly one of the youngest on the course. I think I was only 22 when I started. I think there may have only been one other person even close to my age. So I had the virtue of that. But I will say, you know, it was absolutely one of the worst years of my life. I got torn apart every single class. Looking back on it, I think it's wonderful because it made me a writer. I went through pretty much the worst possible workshop environment I could have been through, but I still wanted to keep going and keep writing. And I think that taught me a whole lot more, especially now that I look back on it.
Tell me about being published first.
I think at 23 by Scepter. My first book was called Roo Kit Kick and the Big Bad Blimp, which is mercifully out of print at the moment. There were a couple really, really good scenes in it, but it just didn't hold together, I don't think, as an entire novel. And it's mainly because I think I was still learning how to write one. But it was bought by a really incredible editor, Helen Garnons Williams. I think she really saw something in it, but due to some very strange publication schedule, didn't end up getting published for 19 or 20 months, you know, after she'd actually bought it. And in the meantime, DBC Bierre's book had come out and won the Booker. And by the time mine came out, it was viewed as a copycat, mm-hmm. which was really rough, you know, for a first novel. I think because of that, and I'm not privy to the thinking, but Kung Fu High School was my second book. That came out relatively soon after. That one really came from the heart for me. One of the most influential people in my life, very much a big sister, and no one would know this about her except for those closest to her. She grew up in a gang, and she's really been there for me for the last 20 years or so of my life, and has really kind of shepherded me and helped me make the best decisions I can. So to write essentially a gang story with a female protagonist who's the central character, Jen, in Kung Fu High School, in addition to, you know, it kind of bumped into my feelings about Columbine and high school violence and just how terrifying guns are and can be. I was with a number of folks from Littleton, Colorado, the day that happened. We all went to university together, and we all ended up bunkered in a room watching the news coverage of what was happening. Two of the guys in that room had siblings who were in the high school when it happened. They were calling home frantically. We didn't know if they were alive or dead. 2 years after that, I had a roommate who was a survivor of the shootings. And it was very strange because the entire time, everyone had all these opinions and thoughts about it. And the media was blaming everyone from, you know, Marilyn Manson to Eminem. And yet the people who I knew, who had very direct experience of it, one of the guys, his father ended up being the FBI lead investigator, you know, we never said anything. We never talked about it. It just stayed kind of stuck within us. And it was years later when I was living in London that I actually picked up the phone and said, I think I want to write about high school violence. And I happened to call a party where all of those guys, including my former roommate, were in the room together. And I basically asked permission. I'd never done that before, but I said, yeah, is it all right if I write about this? And the only thing James said was, make it art, which I thought, was a really profound and beautiful thing to say, you know, and that's what I went with. And that's where I took perhaps the fantastical concept of a high school where everyone must fight in order to determine their social value and tried to wrap it into something larger.
And of course, that theme of violence returns in All Involved, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. You carried on teaching, but one of the things you did was you started a program on teaching people to write video games.
It's true, yes. It wasn't my idea, Georgina, I can tell you that. It was actually the students. A couple of my former students had gone on to work at one of the largest video game companies, in the world, which is right there in Orange County, called Blizzard. They do Warcraft, among other things. And they had said, gosh, it would have been so amazing if we had a course that was designed to teach interactive narrative. I'm not much of a video game player. I was never really interested in it. But when the student said, this is what we want to do, I said, all right, you know, I figure out a way to do that. It was for me, I think, the course I'm most proud of in retrospect, especially because the very first course we had majority female students. So we had about 65 to 70% women, which as far as the industry is concerned, it's almost the opposite of that, if not 80 to 90% men to 10 to 20% females. And I thought it could potentially be a really wonderful way to address the chauvinism and the ridiculousness in the gaming world. But we had to start at story and focus on that. But one of my former students from that class, Nicole Martinez, has gone on to be a lead writer at Telltale. They do the Game of Thrones games. They do the Walking Dead games. They win all these awards. They, you know, they get written about in The Atlantic and The New Yorker. And it's just, it's really wonderful to have contributed, you know, a student to that environment.
How do you write a video game?
How much time do you have? Because it's really, it can be quite difficult. But I think the most important thing is to keep in mind really basic concepts of storytelling that work in every medium. It doesn't matter if it's film. It doesn't matter if it's a novel. You know, everything from detail to cause and effect to making certain we know how a character feels in a given moment, which is especially useful in video games because the player needs to be able to relate. And the player can't relate if they're not given an indicator or a sign. Obviously, there are ways to be subtle about that. There are ways to be kind of over the top about that. But I teach about five essentials of storytelling, regardless of medium. And we just stick to that. And then it's a matter of potentially teasing out multiple threads given an important player choice. So in a novel, I do only write one thread as far as that's concerned. A really difficult choice comes up. The character makes A, B, or C and moves on. But in video games, you have to do A, B, C, possibly D. There are multiple options for each one, and that certainly changes the story, provided, you know, you're focused on consequence, which you should be.
Mm. Just like those old books that you used to get, a kind of multiple choice book. I remember having such fun with those as a
Choose Your Own Adventure.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah. I taught a number of Choose Your Own Adventure books. But we also looked at why those are a solid model, but also why they are a flawed model in terms of thinking of your character and your player having the richest experience possible.
So interesting. Another area that you're involved with is street art. Now, I'm not going to call it graffiti because you're kind of state-sanctioned.
Well, we are, I suppose, city-sanctioned.
Yeah.
You know, street art is a really useful kind of catch-all term, but I think what we tend to do more is murals. Los Angeles has this incredibly rich tradition of muralism all the way back to Siqueiros and Diego Rivera. Really, some of the most beautiful, important murals in the world are in Los Angeles. And I think only now we're making certain they're restored and kept well. More than anything, I think for me, it just taught me so much about the city. I actually was at a point in my career where I actually thought I was done being a writer. I thought, you know, after we had tried to sell a book that I had been working on for 8 years and at one point was over 250,000 words, really a poor decision on my part, if I may say so. I really wasn't thinking of the reader, which is very stupid. But I got to this point where my U.S. agent actually fired me after he'd read it, or probably read two chapters of it, decided he didn't like it. And I happened to meet a few folks in this crew in Los Angeles, and we just got along really well. They had read Kung Fu High School, which was an amazing surprise to me. They said, oh, wow, we love that book. Would you like to be part of our crew? I said, yes, absolutely. I was up for an adventure. I was very down in general at that point. And they said, great, you're our intern. And I said, oh, my God, what does that mean? Because, you know, I was 33 years old and, you know, fighting to stay on the bottom rung of the university teaching system. I didn't know that I could handle another very serious blow to the ego, but it actually was one of the smartest things I've ever done in my life, even though I didn't know if I wanted to do it, but they basically said, carry paint, help us set up a projector, you know, help us scout locations, and when we're there, talk to people. And so I basically went to any number of neighborhoods that perhaps as a white male living in Los Angeles, I never would have gone to, because certainly people warned me off of them. Don't go to Compton. Don't go to Linwood. Don't go to Lincoln Heights, and on and on and on. There are these very strange social no-go zones in Los Angeles that people are all too willing to speak against. And yet if you ask them if they've ever been there, of course they say no, which you should consider the source in that point. But I think for me, it was just this fascinating education that really went above and beyond my grad work in a way. Perhaps it was postgraduate work, just sitting there talking to people in any number of neighborhoods and hearing their perspective and where they're coming from. And I could, you know, talk to kids and older people of every creed and color. And I just was mesmerized by the amount of perspectives that were available that I'd just never seen before. We embarked on a mural project that was very ill-fated, where I tried to combine QR codes with what we were putting on the wall in an effort to really connect people to a story, allow them to share their stories with us so that we could put their stories on walls. It just didn't work out. I think mainly because at the time people just didn't understand QR codes or how to read them or how to connect. And that was my fault. That was flawed from the beginning. But I think I really, really held on to this idea of telling Los Angeles stories and telling them from multiple perspectives. And perhaps that's what tailed into and really drove all involved when I came to it.
All of this work that you've been talking about comes together in your latest book, All Involved, which is an extraordinary piece of work. A heartbreaking portrait of a city tearing itself apart is one of the blurbs. It's been incredibly well reviewed. It's very difficult to read because it is so heart-wrenching on so many levels. And actually, what I thought was, and I would not normally do this on this program, but because the writing is so extraordinary here, I wonder if you would just read us a passage.
Oh, sure, I'd love to.
And so the context of this is it's the riots in Los Angeles in 1992.
In 1992, and this particular narrator is named Ernesto Vera. He's an innocent man. He's been targeted for reasons that are made clear later in the book, but he's been attacked by gang members, and he's been hurt very badly and kind of left in the street. The car kicks up gravel on me as it goes. I'm still breathing, but it's wet. Half blood. I'm numbing up all over. I try to roll. I think if I can turn over, the blood will just fall out and not choke me, but I can't. I see a new shape above me. I blink hard and it's a face. It's a lady brushing hair from her eyes as she leans over. She's telling me she's a nurse. To stay still. I want to laugh. I want to tell her I can't move, so not to worry. I'll stay still because I can't do anything else. I want to tell her to tell my sister what happened. There's another shape beside her. A smaller one. It looks like the boy I saw almost, but it's too fuzzy to tell. I hear the kid's voice clear, though. This fool's gonna die, huh? For a second. I think he's talking about somebody else. Not me. The lady whispers something I can't hear then, and I feel hands on me. Not hands, so much as pressure. The pain isn't the biggest deal. The problem is I can't breathe. I try and I can't. My chest won't rise. Feels like a car's parked on it. I try to tell them this. If they could please tell the car to move, I'll be fine. It won't be so heavy. And I can breathe, and everything will be okay if I can just get air. I try to shout this, any of it. But my mouth won't work. And my skin feels big, loose. And the sky feels too close.
like it fell on me, on my face like a sheet. And I have the strangest feeling like it's coming down to me, that it's getting inside me with some dark kind of concrete, trying to patch my holes up and make it so I can breathe. And I think how good that be if that were true, but I know I'm just dying. The kid is right. I know I think I'm just melting into it because my brain's low on oxygen, and I know because that's logic, because brains don't work right without food, and I know I'm not really becoming part of the sky. And I know because. I know because.
It's an incredibly powerful piece of writing, and the act of putting that down, I mean, I can see how emotional it makes you just reading it. So how was writing it?
It was the toughest thing I've ever done. I don't know that the stakes could have been higher to start a book with a narrator who essentially passes away on the page. I have to make the reader care in 13 pages, 14 pages, enough to emotionally feel that, enough to buy into the plot hinge, into the sister potentially wanting to take revenge for this. I just felt like there were a million ways to do it wrong and alienate the reader and send them out, you know, never to even turn the page. And there was probably only one way to do it right. I think for me, one of the reasons why I get so emotional is because I spent so much time with former gang members, many of whom have been stabbed and shot, and have explained to me in kind of vivid detail what that feels like. As a survivor of violence myself, I just sit there wrapped, and I feel it along with them. I think there's something really specific and potent about stories that touch on physical pain between survivors. I think we have an almost electric understanding of each other. It has nothing to do with race or culture. It has everything to do with humanity and just the depth of understanding. I know that so many former gang members would never have even thought of speaking to me if I hadn't shared my own story of what happened to me. And I think it helped that it also happened to me when I was 17, because this was when a lot of these folks were out gangbanging and making terrible decisions and getting hurt themselves. I think there was very much a fidelity there. But it changed me to sit at the dinner tables and meet mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles, you know, who always, to a person, had stories of how death had touched them and taken away their kids and aunts and uncles and cousins. It was a weight. And at least for me, the only way I could really deal with that was write it.
How do you think Los Angeles has moved on from those riots? Because, I mean, a lot of your characters question who L.A. belongs to now.
Oh, absolutely.
Who does it belong to?
Oh, that's a really difficult question, because I think there are 100 different answers and they're all true, mainly because L.A. is the most diverse city in the entire United States. There was a recent study that came out that confirmed this. The number two city that is the most diverse city in the United States is Long Beach, which is part of L.A. County. This is hilarious and true. You know, you can find almost every language spoken on earth. You can find people from almost every country. And it almost depends on the part. You know, if you're talking about San Gabriel Valley, you could say, well, the Chinese own it. It's the largest Chinese diaspora outside of China. If you're talking about Koreatown, you could say the Koreans, and on and on and on. I think there are so many facets of Los Angeles. And up to this point, we've had very simplistic understanding of it, that it's black and white. And I think the 92 riots were a big part of that. But it's a thread that kind of goes through the book. And I think it becomes more important now is the Latino gangs are growing in power and consolidating power. And in Los Angeles County, Latinos are a majority. As Los Angeles goes, so goes the United States. The United States will be majority Latino, I believe, in 2038 was the last guess. But, you know, it always actually gets closer rather than further away when they're revising estimates. It's really fascinating. And I think the beauty of that is, as the writer Gustavo Arellano would say, it's a reconquista of sorts. It's a reconquering of a place that actually used to be Mexico. which is what Los Angeles was, and a good chunk of California for that matter. So I don't know if there is a way to completely understand Los Angeles, period. But I think a wonderful starting point is learning more about the groups that have yet to have been given a clear and strong voice, an understanding, really, of what they've contributed and what they will contribute in terms of cultural dominance moving forward.
Now, you've talked about the violence that was perpetrated, albeit accidentally, upon you when you were 17.
But I think it was accidental. Don't know for sure.
While you were writing this, though, you were undergoing another form of pain during the writing process. I mentioned at the top your tattoo, and I can just see it sort of poking out from your sleeves.
Yes, because the arms are done now as well, and it connects to the
back.
But
it covers your whole body. Now, you were having this done while you were writing the book, and in fact, sometimes it got so painful that you couldn't actually sit to write. That must have fed into the whole writing process in some way.
It did for me, and it's interesting because I never would have chosen to do it while I was writing the book, but we were a bit stuck by deadlines. My tattooer, Chris Brand, he's a genius, and he was asked to be part of a museum show, and the focus was on neo-Japanese tattooing. He fuses Japanese techniques with a Chicano-style black and gray, and he creates this very Los Angeles-feeling aesthetic. In fact, I can go to Germany, I can go to France, and people who know tattoo will just point at me and say, Los Angeles. Which is a very strange feeling, but also very cool in a way that it's recognized so readily and quickly. So we were on a deadline to make sure that the back piece got done in order to be photographed for that museum show as I was writing the last 3 days of the book. So I didn't really have a choice. At least that's how I saw it, because I wanted to be there for him and help provide a proper canvas for his work. But yeah, it was, you know, not that I would ever go in for this idea of method writing, if there even is such a thing. But yeah, I think the most I could sit during the last few days of writing the book was maybe 15 or 20 minutes at a time, at least when that portion of my body was being worked on. It was interesting because I would have to write in bursts, and I think it affected the rhythm and the style of those last few days. If it imbued it with any more pain than is already kind of shot through the book, I don't know. I just did my best.
It seems to me that LA really is the essence of who you are.
I think so. I mean, I hope so. I came as an immigrant, you know, from Colorado, and I was very grateful. Well, I'm grateful now to have lived all over the world, having lived in Norwich and London and Australia, done homestays in Japan. I think being a traveler prepared me really well to live in Los Angeles, because it is a world. I mean, you can get in your car and you can drive to a place where no one speaks English 30 times in a day. And I think there's something special about wanting to feel that and wanting to connect with whatever you can find and hopefully gain a broader understanding of the city along the way. I'm grateful and I keep trying to have adventures and go places I've never been. As I know, it's a little bit like living in London when I lived here. I knew there was no way I could ever see and do everything I wanted to, but you still have to try.
And for anybody else that wants to try, who wants to get a real feeling of what Los Angeles is, you need to read All Involved. It's by Ryan Gatiss. It's published by Picador. Ryan, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to producer Claire Urban. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or our app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.